Welcome to Seed to Scale.
We're four investors with backgrounds as founders who met at the engineering school at the University of Pennsylvania.
Tim Young.
Nihal Mehta.
Hadley Harris.
Vic Singh.
We started ENIAC in 2009.
With more than 80 years of combined experience building our own companies.
We now lead seed rounds and bold founders who use code to create transformational companies.
Starting a company from the ground up is really hard.
In this podcast, we'll be having conversations with some of the most interesting founders, investors, and influencers.
About the ins and outs of building an early stage company.
We talk about it all.
Funding, growth, and everything it takes to build a lasting business.
Hello everyone, this is Tim Young, founding general partner at ENIAC Ventures. Today, I'm excited to be sitting with Clara Sieg, a partner and founding member of Revolution Ventures. Clara is one of the VC's shining stars and someone who has quickly drawn accolades from her work at Revolution.
If you think about it from a very macro perspective, 85% of Fortune 500 companies are headquartered outside of San Francisco, New York, and Boston. But about two-thirds, almost 75% of venture capital goes into those three cities. And that's a huge capital gap.
Recently, Clara has been featured on Forbes 30 Under 30 for venture capital and named LinkedIn's top 10 professionals under 35 for VC and finance. Currently, Clara's work spans investment strategy and execution, oversight of portfolio companies, and fund formation. She sits on several boards, including Framebridge, Policy Genius, and Paro. Hey, Clara, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So we're both from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
We are. Just the best place in the world to grow up.
Is it really?
I believe so.
Wow. And we've seen...
You seem less convinced.
I'm significantly older, but when I was growing up, I remember when thinking back, Pittsburgh's always been a tech hub, but not tech as we think of it today. Like the rivers were lined with steel mills growing up. My grandfather and my father worked in steel mills, but today it's totally different. So like, what is your journey and relationship been with Pittsburgh over the years?
Yeah, so neither of my parents are from Pittsburgh. They moved there shortly before I was born, largely because it was great cost of living. And my dad is a professor at Carnegie Mellon. And I grew up basically on the Carnegie Mellon campus. And it's been awesome to see the evolution as their engineering program has gained real national recognition and one of the top 10 computer science programs in the world, really.
Yeah,
and the technology that's coming out of there now is really interesting. I think historically they have had a lot of sort of solutions looking for problems that weren't as business minded. But I think the Tepper School is really focused on more business formation around the technology that they have and that they're working on. And that's created a lot of interesting opportunities.
Yeah, I remember growing up, CMU was... known but not renowned, and it's really kind of phenomenal how Pittsburgh's blossomed into kind of a high tech hub. And now I feel like it's pretty cliche to be looking for deals outside of San Francisco and New York. And I'm on boards in Seattle and San Diego and Boulder, and I take pride in that. But I'll be honest, it's a fairly recent occurrence. But from the beginning, you've been focused on smaller developing markets, and one, just hats off to that. Being ahead of the curve, but also just curious, like what was behind that? What motivated that?
Yeah, so the history of Revolution, we started as Steve Case's family office really back in 2005 when he left AOL and invested about $500 million across a bunch of early stage stuff that then turned into follow-on opportunities. And the bulk of that was coming from outside of the Bay Area because AOL was headquartered in Virginia, Steve lived in DC, and most of our deal flow just kind of came from other places that were a little bit more off the beaten track. So Zipcar was originally in Portland and then in Cambridge. We did a company called Revolution Money, which Amex acquired, which was headquartered down in Florida. And there were a number of those portfolio companies that we saw most of our returns were coming from outside of the Valley. And so when we institutionalized, we realized that we should create a real strategy around that and focus on that because in the Valley, things are kind of priced to perfection. And if you're not in the handful of companies that are going to define that vintage year returns, then your outcomes are pretty binary because things are so expensive going in that it precludes a lot of options from an M&A perspective. And we saw a real opportunity in... second tier and some third tier cities, where if you think about it from a very macro perspective, 85% of Fortune 500 companies are headquartered outside of San Francisco, New York, and Boston. But about two-thirds, almost 75% of venture capital goes into those three cities. And that's a huge capital gap. And as these ecosystems have grown, so you think about different accelerator programs and even nonprofits and then localized angel groups, you've seen a lot of starting around entrepreneurship, particularly because it's just easier to start companies these days, and some capital and local support at the very early stage, so seed stage, but a huge capital gap at the Series A, Series B level, because a lot of people just don't think it's worthwhile to get on a plane and go to these other cities. So we're able to capitalize on that, right? Valuations are lower, employees are far more loyal, and if you're post money is significantly lower than what it is in a Valley company, your degrees of freedom on exit and on the next round are massively improved.
Right. So second and third tier cities, have you created lines and definitions between these two? Or in my mind, like I'm not clear on what's like a second tier city versus a third tier city.
So we think of it more.
Or is it?
Los Angeles is not a second tier city. But there's still a capital gap there. It's closing in Los Angeles. It's starting to close a little bit more in Austin and Chicago, and some of these cities that 5 years ago the gap was a lot wider. But we really look at it from the perspective of where do you have good legacy talent. So Pittsburgh is a perfect example, right? You have Carnegie Mellon and University of Pittsburgh throwing off a ton of talent every year. You have UPMC, which is a huge healthcare system that retains a lot of talent. And now increasingly, you have Facebook there with Oculus, you have Google, you have Uber working on autonomous there. And those are all big companies that can support talent and where you can have reliable job and employment. And it gives you the degrees of freedom to maybe have the confidence to go start a company and work on something, but then know that there are other options for you in the ecosystem. So I think those are sorts of seeds of cities that are starting to grow. You can look at Raleigh-Durham as a really interesting ecosystem that's very similar to a Pittsburgh. Detroit, Michigan area has grown a lot, and close to that, Ann Arbor as well.
Atlanta, I feel like as well.
Totally, yeah.
There was also traditionally one of the rationalizations, perhaps, of the Series A community is that finding CEOs that could scale a company through a large M&A or to being public or harder to find in smaller markets like Pittsburgh and Atlanta.
Yeah, from our experience, I don't really believe that. I think that's a very narrow view of the world. And I also think that you go back to your underwriting price, right? So if I'm sitting at 20 post and you're sitting at 100 post at a Series A, if we exit that company for $200 million, it's a 10x. If you exit that company in the Bay Area for $200 million, that's not something that you're super excited to write home about.
Right.
And so those dynamics actually really change the magnitude of outcomes at the Series A, Series B level. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to have a $1 billion outcome to have a top quartile, top decile fund.
That's phenomenal. Yeah, and also I think better aligns the venture investors with the entrepreneur.
Yeah. And I think that one of the interesting things about these sorts of cities that don't have the same access to capital is you have founders who are more focused on creating businesses where the unit economics work, where they've bootstrapped for a while, where they have a sense of, you know, that capital isn't going to be flowing in nonstop. And so you are smarter about the dilution you're taking and about the investments that you're making.
You seem to be, you know, really grounded and spend a lot of time on boards. Do you have any tips or thoughts for entrepreneurs managing their board or, you know, going into board meetings?
I do think a lot of the work comes on the front end when you're going through a fundraise process and making sure you're getting the best possible people that you work really well with around the table versus just optimizing for valuation. And I think when you do the former, inherently your board dynamics are going to be a lot better. Making sure that you have a partner who is on board with your vision and excited about what you're building and trusts in your assessment of the opportunities that are ahead of you. There should always be healthy debate and, you know, back and forth on that sort of stuff when you're making important decisions. But trying to optimize for somebody who you get along with, you know, is rational, who is fundamentally somebody you want to spend time with, because this is really a marriage where you're going to be spending time with that person in and out for the next 5 to 10 years, I think is really critical.
Right. That makes sense. The other thing, too, is if you optimize and really drive a hard bargain evaluation and get a super high valuation, the expectations are going to be much higher.
Totally different, yeah.
You know, if you, you know, have like an 80 post for, you know, B versus like 150 post, the expectations of board members are going to be significantly higher, and the room for error and, you know, their amenability to, you know, missing numbers and wavering.
Yeah, and it's not just expectations, right? It's optionality for your company, because pricing something at that level just precludes a number of investors from your next round and a number of strategic options for you.
Right. That makes a ton of sense. Another thing we like to do is the lightning round. So we ask you a couple of questions, and we ask that you just, you know, give us the first reasonable thought that comes to your mind. Best part of being a VC?
I think it's incredibly intellectually rewarding, because you're constantly meeting with people who are smarter than you are and working on really interesting problems.
What is the most challenging part of your day?
I think something that I've had to learn to get comfortable with over the, you know, past 6-7 years that I've been doing this is just saying no in a way that I feel comfortable with.
What verticals are you most excited about these days?
We've been spending a lot of time on fertility and new parent services. When you think about the market from a very high level, 2016 was the first time in recorded history in the U.S. that more women in their 30s gave birth than women in their 20s. And so that shift is enormous, and it's not just a coastal thing.
What's the number one reason early stage companies fail?
I think lack of focus.
What podcast are you listening to right now that we should know about, other than Seed to Scale?
Yeah, Seed to Scale is my main one. Invest Like the Best, I really like. I think it's great to get a broader aperture, not just listen to people who do venture investing. And I think it helps you think about markets from a higher level. I listen to The Daily and NPR Up First every day. And
me
then
too, yeah.
I listen to stuff like Mind Body Green and things like that, because we do a lot in health and wellness, and they have a lot of insights on interesting new emerging brands and trends.
Nice. One last question. There are those that are skeptical that we're going to hit kind of a downturn or a correction in the next, you know, 18 to 24 months. I was wondering, you know, what your thoughts are on that. Are you preparing your fund? Are you preparing your portfolio companies? And do you think there'll be a significantly more effect on second and third tier cities versus San Francisco and New York?
I think second and third tier cities, just because of the way that the companies have started, where they've been bootstrapped more often and less dependent on venture capital, are actually a little bit better insulated from a big correction. But we, if you look back at our annual meeting presentation from January 2015, we've been saying that it's untenable, there's going to be a correction, there's no way that this continues.
I'm sure in that embarrassment. I've been like calling this is going to happen in the next 12
yeah,
months.
Yeah, I'm
for
just
the last
waiting for it to.
Years,
I can't
yeah.
wait for it to happen and then be able to pull up all of our decks.
Yeah.
It's over the past 5 years.
Right.
But I think that honestly, SoftBank has changed the dynamics of when a correction can and will happen.
Mm.
There's just so much capital flowing now, particularly at the later stage, that the can keeps getting kicked down the road.
Well, thanks so much for coming in today. And just to make sure everyone's aware, how can people reach out to you on Twitter, social media?
My Twitter is just at Sieg, at S-I-E-G. It's my last name. And I'm pretty easy to reach on email, too.
Okay. Well, thanks again for your time. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Make sure to follow us on at Seed to Scale and subscribe anywhere you listen to this podcast.